I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, a deep dive crime podcast which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. This case today, you guys have asked for so many times that in the end I thought I've got to do this because otherwise it looks like I'm ignoring you. I'm really not. It's just that there are so many cases that I want to cover, and like any that I am not a fay with, so to speak, there is always that little bit of me that wants to make sure that I do the research effectively, because every single one of these human beings' lives has infinite meaning, and when they're lost, I want to make sure that the legacy that I create on these videos are such that if members of the family come across them or people who were involved in the case come across them, they know that I really did try my best to make sure that the details were diligently researched. It's the murder of Suzanne Capper. And I have to be really honest with you. I have a strong stomach for cases. This is something I've done. I've worked within my career in some of the most tragic situations. I've listened to some of the most devastating stories. I've been witness to things that other people would really struggle to experience. I have a gut that can manage it. But reading this case and figuring out exactly what it was like for Suzanne to endure what I'm going to talk about, the things that she endured, it's something that really did strike me as beyond the realms of human, beyond the realms of our expectation of what people are capable of. Also, this case happened in Manchester, which is obviously where I live. Manchester is actually described as the UK's second city. We all know that the UK's first city would be London, but you know, can have a much bigger house here for a lot less money. That's all I'm saying. But you know, it's known as a big city. But it's also, with respect, having grown up here, a city that is full of extreme economic inequality. There is a huge gap between the richest and the poorest, and it's quite staggering, the disparity between the rich and poor in Manchester. And poverty is still absolutely rife here. In a recent report by Greater Manchester Poverty Action Organisation, they identified 620,000 people are living in poverty in the city region. And that means that people are struggling literally to eat. So when people look at Manchester and they see it as Madchester, the culture of music, and you know, these high rises that look glamorous in the city centre, and the very hipster style living that seems to be everywhere now. The truth is, beneath that is a world of poverty. It's something that I personally really struggle with, because watching that kind of inequality and having worked within it, it stays with you, the fact that there are so many people struggling. And that figure that I was talking about, that 620,000 people who are living in poverty in the city region, that includes 200,000 children. And those 200,000 children are living in substandard housing. They live in areas of high crime, high unemployment, and drug abuse. And sadly, it creates at times a vicious circle. And it's a vicious circle that some people never manage to escape. Now, even though it is really problematic today in 2022, back in the 90s, when I was growing up, the problem was even more apparent. And against the backdrop of street violence, this drug culture, one of the things that stood out was a horrific, absolutely horrific and brutal murder of a teenage girl. And it was the kind of killing at the time that would have and should have rightly shocked a nation. However, at that time, that horrific murder that I'm going to talk about today, it was actually overshadowed because another equally tragic and shocking case played out, and that was the murder of Jamie Bulger. But in spite of the fact that you might not have heard of this particular murder, the torture and the killing of 16-year-old Susan Kappa by a gang led by two sadistic women, or we never have to forget it. And I'm telling that story today because I think that many of us probably haven't heard of it, or we may have caught sight of it but not really paid that much attention to it because other things were going on at the time. So I hope that by the end of this video, you will feel a connection with this woman, you will feel a connection with this young girl and the fact that she met such a tragic and unfair ending. Susan Kappa was born in 1976 in Manchester. When I looked at her history and the accounts that is given of her upbringing, it was relatively dysfunctional. Her mum, Elizabeth, and her father, they split up before she was actually born, and she never actually knew her biological father at all. So Susan and her older sister, Michelle, they at times spent time in the care of the local authority. We all can take a step back and imagine how challenging that is for a child. I appreciate that for some children, going into care is literally a saving grace. They ultimately leave dangerous, abusive scenarios and they find respite, care and sometimes love in the homes of others who step in to be their parents. But it's challenging for most kids. And the fact that Suzanne is in and out of care demonstrates there would be a high level of dysfunction in the home. Now, when Suzanne was still a child, her mum met and married another guy called John. When this relationship failed later on, a 14-year-old Suzanne and her older sister were basically raised largely by their stepfather. So in spite of the fact that he wasn't biologically linked to them, he clearly had a level of responsibility that he felt as a stepfather, and he did try his best to carry out that role. So it seems like Suzanne never had the love, the support, the compassion and care required from her mother. And undoubtedly she will have longed for that. The idea that your stepfather steps in where your own biological mother fails, even though that means that you are getting an understanding that good people exist and that you don't have to be biologically related to somebody to love them, it also amplifies the abandonment by your actual mother, because this man doesn't have to care for you, but he is doing. But the person who actually birthed you, they don't seem to feel that level of responsibility towards you whatsoever. And I think that this is why she starts looking for love elsewhere. She wants to belong, she wants to connect. Anybody who has ever come from a level of dysfunction or been abandoned by a primary caregiver or felt that their family don't cherish them, understandably, you want to go find people who make you feel noticed. Being visible as a human isn't just about wanting to stand out. It's about wanting to have some form of meaning in this world. And for Suzanne, she didn't necessarily feel that. So she looks for other places where she can feel that level of connection. And if you can't find that in good places, if you're getting rejected in areas that could be pro-social and positive, and people aren't welcoming to you, and you don't get to break in to good peer groups, you're gonna find somewhere to belong. And for her, unfortunately, caused her to fall in with a very, very bad crowd. Now, she had attended Moston Brook High School, but then, even though she had done okay at school, she starts missing it. And she also ends up in a situation where, as opposed to having a place of safety at home where she can return to every single evening, she starts couch surfing. She goes round different houses in the area of Moston, and this means that she's meeting people who aren't necessarily individuals with her best interests at heart. And look, people seek out vulnerability, don't they? If you're a predator or you're a bully or you're somebody who wishes to exploit an individual, you don't want to go for people with strong foundations, because people with strong foundations often have support networks and they cause you trouble. You know, if you steal from that person, if you bully that person, if you harm that person, there are going to be consequences, because the family will reap those consequences upon you, and rightfully so. But if you are a kid, a young teenager, and you're sleeping on people's couches, and not even the same couch, you're going from place to place, if I'm a predator, you are instantly vulnerable. I'm going to be able to tell straight away that I'm going to get to exploit you in a different way to how I would exploit somebody else, or be unable, in fact, to exploit anybody else. So she ends up hanging out with people who basically lived within a culture of violence, which is completely the opposite to Suzanne. Suzanne wasn't violent at all. She wasn't a bad young person. She was gentle. She was kind-hearted. She was really well-mannered, and that will play out at the end of this in such a profound way. But the fact that she was always pleasant, she knew her pleases and her thank yous, she was kind, she was an individual that always had nice things to say about other people, but she was also incredibly young. And she was incredibly naive. And because she was incredibly naive, she was desperate to belong. She wanted to fit in. She wanted friends. She was easily led. Now, 26-year-old Jean Powell, she had a house which was one of the places that Suzanne often stayed. Bear in mind, there's a 10-year age difference. So Jean Powell is a woman who really shouldn't be hanging out with 16-year-olds. It's not necessarily a friendship that you would find meant there was a relationship because of the relating between. I appreciate there will be 26-year-olds out there who take in 16-year-olds in a more of a mentoring parental role, because understandably that can be really effective and that can be really growing. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about a relationship that was meant to be more of a friendship. And this Powell lives in a small terraced house on Langworthy Road, Moston. It's an area that I actually used to work, so I know it really, really well. It's about half a mile as well from where Suzanne had lived with her stepfather. So this is local to Suzanne. And Suzanne had actually babysat for Powell in the past, and she'd done it for free. So again, we're building this picture of Suzanne, aren't we? She's an individual who doesn't have very firm, strong roots, but she's obviously a trusted party. The fact that Powell will let her look after her children, and the fact that she does it for free, well, that tells you something as well, doesn't it? It means that she wants to please. Now, Powell herself was a single mother of three children, and they got to know each other essentially because Suzanne had become friendly with Powell's younger brother. They'd briefly dated, as teenagers do, and that's how she'd initially started frequenting Powell's house. However, despite the fact that Powell and Suzanne had known each other for some time, it wasn't a friendship, so to speak. So even though Suzanne probably wanted to be her friend and wanted to hang out and have those kind of pleasant connections and relationships with Powell, Powell didn't see it that way. As far as Powell was concerned, she saw that Suzanne had literally nowhere else to go, and that meant that she was vulnerable and that she could bully her. And that's what she did. She was a real bully to Suzanne, this 26-year-old woman, this mother of three, and she sees this kid in need, and as opposed to wanting to care for her, she just thinks about how she can exploit her. So one of the things that she actually does is she makes Suzanne do a cleaning job when Suzanne's actually meant to be at school, and she keeps most of the wages. Which, when you think about modern day slavery, kind of fits that paradigm, doesn't it? That she literally stops Suzanne having an education and makes her work and then just pockets the cash. Also, Powell lived in a disgusting, squalid home. Now, I appreciate that it's really difficult when you are poor to have things that other people can afford because you are literally living hand to mouth. But I have worked in poverty and I'm committed to that whole world because of my experience. And I have been to places where they are literally living on super noodles for every meal, and their home, you could eat your dinner off the floor because they keep everything perfect. They are house proud. They may not have a lot, but they are house proud, particularly when they have children, because they are caring about their kids. It is an issue if you are living in a squalid environment and you have children. It means that you do not care for your children in a way that you should. It's not a safe environment. Powell fits that paradigm perfectly. So Powell was unemployed. She had an interest in the occult. I know, delightful. Can imagine that evenings there were a great deal of fun. She dealt drugs from the property, and she was also known to handle stolen cars. So we're talking that she is somebody who is confident, isn't she? I mean, the fact that she's making money selling drugs, yeah, okay, that's one thing. There were a lot of low-level dealers, and at the end of the day, they kind of just get that extra cash, so on and so forth. But somebody's actually dealing in stolen cars who is female is quite rare. Also, her house, in spite of the fact that she's got three kids and should care about those kids and should be thinking about their needs and certainly not introducing them to individuals that could be dangerous for her children, yeah, in spite of that, she allows people who are really quite hardened drug users to use her home. So they would come in, shoot up, leave. You won't be surprised to know that the occupants who attended that house were often known to cause trouble. They would get into fights with neighbours, which is a horrific scenario if you happen to be unlucky enough to live next door to them. I mean, literally the worst kind of neighbour. Not only are they drug dealers, but people are often fighting there. People are often rowdy. And if you dare to go around and say, can you please shut up? I've got kids in my home. They'd probably beat you up. So arguably, it's really difficult for people in neighborhoods like that to challenge the status quo because they know the repercussions can be very, very hostile. But bear in mind the fact that Suzanne, we know, is being exploited. At the same time, remember what it's like to be a teenager. You know, you're around naughty things. There's drugs, there are people being loud and rowdy, music playing, allowed to avoid school, albeit that you're being put to work in a cleaning job that you're not actually earning money from. The point is, it will have certain allure to it. It just does. Even though it's not good for you, and people who are adults can look and say, this is not going to work out well. As a kid, you're not thinking about next week, next year, 10 years down the line. You're just thinking about, how does it feel to have these people around me who are older and are more mischievous than me? You're not thinking about the long-term potential consequences. I mean, when I was younger, I can genuinely remember going to people's houses and they were like grown-ass men. And, you know, they were dealing. And you would see a whole heap of kids and young adults and people under the influence walking in and out. And you just kind of be sat there watching it thinking, this is cool. On reflection, you're like, you were insane for even ever conceptualizing that that was acceptable. And no, it wasn't cute that there were kids of like 12 and 13 sleeping on the couches there. It didn't make that individual the Pied Piper in a positive way. It just meant there was a massive degree of dysfunction, and it's okay to some degree looking back because you were just a visitor there, but nonetheless, it makes you realize that as a young person, you don't see things in any way, shape or form in a technical reality that you will do as an adult reflecting back. So she's probably excited by this. And that's what's really sad, because that would have blurred her vision about the absolute imminent danger that she was in. Now, as I've said, Suzanne spent a lot of time with her stepfather, and he was really concerned about her staying at Powell's more and more. And he did say that he didn't want her to. He felt that they were a very bad influence. Suzanne's older sister had actually stayed there previously for a time. And the reason that she left was because she just realised there were so many unscrupulous characters there. And she even referred to them as Powell's evil friends. So there is a warning there, isn't there? That Suzanne's older sister could just sniff out that these individuals were very odd. Maybe it was the occult stuff. Maybe she was like, I am not sure that Powell is an individual who is incapable of sacrifice. I shall vacate these premises, just thinking that that's some kind of potential. Arguably, she's absolutely right. Powell is one dark character, and she's not alone. She has some seriously dodgy acquaintances. And the way that I would express them, the way that I would describe them, is that they were like a group of overgrown, dysfunctional, big kids. Yes, they were adults, but they were not emotionally mature by any stretch of the imagination. And there was a complexity of these interwoven relationships, like a web of these oddly intertwined relationships going on. One of these was 24-year-old Bernadette McNeely. Now, McNeely had a history of drug addiction, and she'd originally moved into a house just a few doors down from Powell, but then she ends up moving in with Powell. Now, similarly to Powell, she also was a single mom. She also had three kids. So Powell and McNeely would actually sleep on a bed downstairs, and the kids would all sleep upstairs. So the six kids occupied the bedrooms upstairs. And if you can imagine the kind of life that a child requires, you know, consistency, being protected, being made to feel safe, loved, cared for, just, you know, the basics of Maslow's hierarchy of needs fulfilled. Yeah, that didn't happen. Powell and McNeely were completely chaotic, beyond belief. They should not have even been allowed to have their kids. Simple as that. They are the archetypal poster family for kids that need removing from their home. It was completely in disarray. There was barely any furniture. It was horrible. And it was squalid, and it was despicable for children to live there. Another completely dysfunctional yet frequent visitor to the house was Powell's ex-husband. That was 29-year-old Glyn Powell, and he lived nearby. He did have a list of previous convictions, including burglary and theft. I know, model father. We have model parents here, aren't we? Dealing with individuals that we'd all like to be friends with. McNeely's boyfriend, Anthony Judson, they were also at the house. He was 16. Yeah, 16 years old. 8 years younger than McNeely. Don't get me started with a whole heap of how wrong that is. Also, he was having sex with Powell. Yeah? Why not? Why not just have sex with the 16-year-old schoolboy, basically? That's not weird, is it? That doesn't say something deeply disturbing about your psyche and acceptability levels. And I know, in the UK, at 16, you can legally have sex with somebody who is older than you, but I am telling you now, 24-year-old and 26-year-old women, it is not acceptable by any stretch of the imagination. Also, he had been in a sexual relationship with Suzanne at one point, which is acceptable because Suzanne was his age. But nonetheless, this is deeply dysfunctional, isn't it? And we all know how conflictual, competitive, and problematic it can become if there is an individual having relationships with more than one person and those people all know each other. It's a potential for jealousy, envy, and rage. Now, there were two other people that are going to play key roles in the case that I'm going to talk about. That's Powell's 18-year-old brother, Clifford Pook. He'd been Suzanne's ex-boyfriend. He was also known to be an individual who'd been recognised as having low intelligence. And Powell had personally introduced him to amphetamines at a young age, which can be disastrous for young people because your brain is developing all the way to 25. And anything that you can introduce as far as drugs, as far as alcohol is concerned, can have an impact. and he already had certain developmental issues. And the other person is Powell's 27-year-old boyfriend, Jeffrey Lee. And he would often call round at the house to buy amphetamines. He'd been known in the past to do some heinous things, previously having robbed and threatened his elderly, disabled aunt with a knife. There are so many things I could say about that. The fact that he went for somebody who was disabled is one. I mean, can you get any more disgusting as a human being? That you go for somebody who already has problems with their ability to even fight back, but then she was elderly, so it makes her even more vulnerable. But my God, it was his aunt. Literally, he was related to her. So clearly not a sophisticated criminal, because your aunt's going to recognise you for a start. But if you're going to harm somebody who is old and elderly, I think it kind of examples and exemplifies who you are as a human being, doesn't it? So he actually got 3 years in the Young Offenders Institute for that. So he has been, to some degree, institutionalised. You can just imagine, can't you, as I describe those characters, how different Suzanne is to them. She's not somebody with a criminal history. She's somebody who's been known as sweet and kind and compassionate. She's a victim of circumstance. She's arrived there because she hasn't got the foundations that she deserved. Simple as that. And somehow, because of this chain of causation, of not having a mother who loved her and cared for her and cherished her enough, she ends up well and truly embroiled with this group of reprobates, shall we say. And she even starts having conversations with her sister, telling her sister that they all bully her. And you think, Suzanne, you don't deserve that. Get out, leave. But just like in so many, shall we say, coercive, controlled relationships where you're kind of nice to somebody one day and then you're really horrible to them the next, it places somebody in a state of confusion. And even though they can recognise that to some degree their reasoning with unreasonable, because they're so desperate for a sense of connection and belonging, they'll take the scraps of positivity, the scraps of nice comments. It doesn't matter that it's literally drowned in all of this deviousness and deceit and negativity. That doesn't matter. You're just wanting the good bits. So she continues to go there. She's desperate for attention. Now, apparently the bullying starts to get really bad and she ends up getting assaulted by Powell and McNeely. And at this point, we're talking about two grown women. Two grown women attacking a teenager. Now, late in 1992, Suzanne asks her mum if she can go and stay overnight at her mother's house, right? Bear in mind, this is Suzanne knocking on the door of her biological mother and asking, could I stay with you overnight? She's got bruises on her face. According to Suzanne's sister, her mother said no. Turned her away. She said that her new boyfriend wouldn't like it. Now, I appreciate that women and men make decisions about their new partners that I will never align myself with. You got a kid, they're your priority. That's it. It's never a no when your child's in need. And if the boyfriend or the girlfriend doesn't like it, well, that's a surefire way to know that they should not be your girlfriend or your boyfriend. I am so angry telling you that Suzanne's own mother saw her bruised face and said no, she couldn't stay because her new boyfriend wouldn't like it. Because obviously that's who you should be caring about when your kid turns up looking like they might have been beaten up. Now, according to her mother, of course, the woman who literally has basically abandoned her, she says that that wasn't the case. You know, she just moved into a new flat. She was in the process of preparing Suzanne's room and claims that her daughter was going to be moving in at Christmas. So if you're so committed to, you know, creating a space for your daughter in your home, if you're looking forward to her moving into the degree where you're getting all beautiful, prepped and prepared, and it's going to be a gorgeous room for her in your home, why the hell wouldn't you let her sleep on the couch? She's not three. She wasn't waiting for a big reveal. You know? You weren't on a program of changing rooms where you can't see it till the very end. She had bruises on her face. She needed somewhere to stay. Why didn't you let her stay there? Susan ends up, because of this, going back to Powell's house. Powell's house, by this point, Susan's stepfather was referring to it as the house of evil. And her father was right. Because when she goes back to that house, it seems like this gang of oddballs and social rejects have decided that Susanna somehow slighted them. So they start accusing her of various things, really petty, petty stuff. And bear in mind, when we've made a decision about actions that we wish to take, what we will do is seek to validate those through other people saying, that's a good idea, or yes, that person did do that and requires this kind of punishment, and so on and so forth. And it's amazing how, when you decide on a course of action, and you all decide that that would be a course of action that you'd like to take, you look for any little tiny detail that could support you in that campaign, both positively and negatively. So the fact that they start throwing these really petty things that they say Susanna has done is because they are looking for a permission base to their behaviour. They were looking for an excuse for a campaign of violence against this vulnerable, defenceless, lovely teenager. McNeely, well, she decides that she and her boyfriend Dudson had caught pubic lice from Suzanne that previous month. They said that she had slept in a bed before them. They had then slept in that bed and they had basically caught pubic lice. And they even say that they had to shave off their pubic hair. Just gonna throw it out there. That shows how stupid they are, because shaving off your pubic hair is not going to resolve the issue completely. You usually have to go and actually seek help from a GP and get some special lotion. Also, the idea that they would have been sleeping in a bed and got pubic lice from the bed is very strange, because of the time frame that would have been involved between apparently Suzanne being there and them getting in there, which evidences this is not about Suzanne giving them pubic lice. This is about them just wanting to blame somebody for their own sexually troubling behaviour that had led to this situation. Now, Dudson later on actually claimed that he thought he'd caught them from McNeely, which he will have, and they were all sleeping with each other, weren't they? So if somebody's gonna have something, it's gonna get pushed on to another person. And with respect, how 1980s to be talking about pubic lice? I thought they died out with, I don't know, syphilis? No, I know syphilis still exists as well. You know what I'm saying though. Anyway, given the fact that they were all sleeping with each other at this time, it just seems far more likely that that's how pubic lice had been passed on. Then they say, well, at least McNeely comes up with this idea, that Suzanne had stolen a £50 pink duffel coat of hers. Like, why would Suzanne do that? Firstly, it's pink. She would be seen walking around the local area in said pink duffel coat. It's not something you can hide, is it, when you happen to be visiting places locally all the time? So again, this is just trying to make out that she is an individual who deserves some kind of punishment. Powell then chips in and alleges that Suzanne's tried to persuade her to sleep with a man for money. Apparently the pair have both previously met a guy called Mohammed Yusuf. That's a friend of a friend from Sale. And allegedly, Suzanne had encouraged Powell to have sex with him. I mean, we are clasping at straws at this point, aren't we? Like, let's just put it in this context. Let's just go with what Powell is saying. Well, Suzanne suggested that I should have sex with this guy for money. And what did you say? I said, no. Yes? Does it go any further than that? No, that's it. So arguably, she's not some Machiavellian mass manipulator sexually exploiting you by forcing you to have sex with a guy that you don't want to have sex with. No. So the very worst of this situation that we're playing out right now is that Suzanne said, why don't you sleep with that guy for money? You said no and you didn't do it. Yes. How does that result in Suzanne deserving any kind of punishment? It doesn't. I was just trying to figure out some kind of strategies so that I can exercise my right to violence. That's what we're talking about here. Now, Yusuf also later denied this, and Powell would actually later tell the police that she had given Suzanne a good hiding for trying to make me go with an Arab. Wow. Powell's really the kind of person that seems like a pro-social type of little bunny, doesn't she? That she would actually acknowledge to the police that she's just a massive racist as well. Because that's what she's saying, isn't she? That she's a massive racist. And she's admitting to the police in this moment that simply for Suzanne apparently suggesting that she should sleep with this guy, she deserves retribution of getting a good hiding. Arguably, we're introduced to just how antisocial Powell's mindset is. Also, I'm going to throw it out there. Powell, sleep with someone for money? Would she be the kind of person to do that? Well, she's certainly the kind of somebody that will sleep with 16-year-old boys for free. So I don't know. Maybe it was reasonable to suggest that you could make 50 quid doing that. But now the gang have created these ridiculous misdemeanors that aren't even based in truth or facts. This has given them their desired impact, which is a reason to harm Suzanne. They have now decided that these invented faux pas of Suzanne means that she needs to be taught a lesson. And my God, what a lesson they believe that she deserved. On the 7th of December 1992, Powell lures 16-year-old Suzanne from her stepfather's home to her house. She basically says to Suzanne, there's a guy here that you fancy. And that's heartbreaking, isn't it? Because when you're a kid, you know, you're 16, you fancy somebody. Remember what that was like? Before we had to pay bills and mortgages and before the weight of responsibility infected our opportunity to just daydream and fantasize about possibility, and where so much of your life was taken up with the ideas of that first kiss of the person that you like, and Suzanne is coerced into arriving at her address because of that. Powell gets her to her address because she makes her believe that this boy is there that she likes, and she probably got her makeup on and got herself looking nice, just in the hope that she's gonna see, catch sight, have a conversation with that boy. When she arrives at Powell's address, she's completely unsuspecting, she's completely unaware, but she's immediately accosted by Glyn Powell and Dudson. She's held down on the kitchen floor. And at this point, while she's being restrained, while she's confused and shocked, surprised, she doesn't understand this. Glyn Powell shaves off her hair and shaves off her eyebrows. She's 16. 16, imagine what that would feel like. It's your hair, it's your eyebrows. They are definingly feminine. It's what so many of us spend enormous amounts of money on, making sure our eyebrows look nice, making sure that our hair looks shiny, because it is part of our personality, our individuality, our uniqueness, and it's part of our attraction to others. And it matters to human beings to be seen as attractive. She's 16 and vulnerable. the power play in removing her femininity in this way, in dehumanizing her when she's completely unprepared. What must have been running through that child's mind? I have no idea. After they have assaulted her in this most heinous of ways, they actually make her clean her hair up from the floor. She will have been blindsided in this moment. She will not be able to process what is going on. The adrenaline will be coursing through her veins. All she will feel is fear and shock. But then Glyn Powell stands her up. He places a black plastic bag over her head, and then he repeatedly hits her on the head whilst walking her around, whilst parading her around. She can't see anything. She's in shock. And then the pain as he hits her again and again. And then Powell and McNeely join in. They repeatedly start to kick her. This is when she's laying curled up on the floor in agony. They beat her with a heavy 3 foot long ornamental wooden spoon and a belt. This is out of nowhere. 16-year-old kid. And then they pick her up off the floor and they take her to the bathroom. And then they humiliate her. They make her shave off her pubic hair. This is payback for allegedly giving Dudson and McNeely pubic lice. Out of nowhere, guys. Imagine what this 16-year-old child is thinking. And then after these assaults, Powell locks her in a wardrobe downstairs overnight. She's just kept prisoner. Kept prisoner in a wardrobe. Little room to move around, injured, in agony, terrified, shaved. Like every single one of her worst nightmares, all coming true. And these are people that may have bullied her, but my God, she trusted them. She liked them. She wanted to be a part of their gang. And this is her payback. Her payback for doing absolutely nothing to them. The next morning, she's taken out of that cupboard and then they lock her in a cupboard upstairs. So again, defenseless, powerless, helpless. This is in a house where there are children. This is how deranged and dangerous this group of human beings are. This is how uncaring they are. They don't care about the fact that children may be hearing a young woman crying. No, they're not concerned about the impact on those kids. But later on in that day, they decide to move her to an abandoned house down the road. That's McNeely's house. Remember, they're living with Powell at this moment in time, so they have this space down the street. At this point, this is because they feel that the constant crying is disturbing the children. So they are aware that Suzanne is in agony. She is crying constantly. They actually get angry with her because they feel that she is disturbing the children. That she is disturbing the children. Not that their violent, unprovoked assault on this poor, defenseless 16-year-old is the reason the kids can hear the crying. No, because you know what? Suzanne just can't shut up. Another reason for them to be angry with her. They take her to this property and then they just tie her to the slats of an upturned bed frame in one of the downstairs rooms. And again, they are doing this to humiliate her. They get cord, rope, electric flex, belts, and a chain. And they position her spread eagle, arms and legs apart. It's a very vulnerable way of chaining a woman. It means that the potential for sexual assault is always there. It's beyond terrifying and humiliating all in the same moment. They stuff socks in her mouth because they want to gag her. She's 16. She's 16 years old. She's done nothing wrong. She's not even fought back. She's just complied because she's so scared. Now, Suzanne had already been imprisoned against her will. She'd been subjected to this unjustified violence, this unjustified abuse. But guys, this was only the beginning, because she was about to be subjected to days of absolutely terrifying, reprehensible, horror movie style torture. But this is in reality. This is going to be Suzanne's reality. What's utterly devastating about what plays out is that her stepfather cared for Suzanne. He really did. He'd warned her not to go to that house. But obviously, because she came and went, and sometimes she stayed elsewhere, he's completely oblivious to her situation. Because Suzanne often stayed at Powell's. We already know that her mother saw her probably whenever she wanted on her terms, but not regularly. So her mother presumes that she's at her stepfather's. Her stepfather is presuming that she'll be at one of her friends or at her mother's. And that means that no one is even going to come to her aid. Over the next few days, Suzanne is subjected to a horrific amount of beatings. She's burned with cigarettes. She's injected with amphetamines. This is all whilst she is left restrained on the bed. She can't move. She can't eat. She can't drink. She can't use the bathroom. She's just left in her own waste. Imagine being injected with amphetamines. For those of you who've never taken amphetamines, it makes you feel very edgy. It makes, at times, you have quite a bad stomach ache, in fact. It makes you feel paranoid at points, and it makes you really want to get up and move around. So being restrained is completely the opposite of what your body is going to be telling you what to do. But add to that the fact that she's going to be feeling things more, it would also incite levels of pain. So she's going to be in a situation where she feels completely out of control. She's not consented to having these drugs put into her body, and injecting them in the body is a really high level impact. And then she's going to be feeling all of this on edge when she's already dealing with the most horrifying psychological and physical abuse that she could have ever even envisaged and entertained, even in her worst nightmares. But they also, they place headphones over her ears and they play rave music at full volume, this complete sensory overload, absolutely no control over what she's being exposed to. They also play a song by 150 volts. And it goes, "Hi, I'm Chucky, wanna play?" And if you guys don't know who Chucky is, he's a horrific looking freaky little doll that comes alive and murders people. I mean, literally the creators of Chucky, they all need to have psychiatric evaluations, in my opinion. Just throwing it out there, you gotta be a whole heap of weird to think about a little baby doll coming alive and murdering people, particularly with a very strong, deep male accent. And there's some whole heap of inappropriate sexual stuff that goes in those films as well. But who am I to judge? Anyway, they have this particular favourite by playing this because it symbolises torture. It actually becomes a theme. McNeely would commence every single torture session by whispering the same line in her ear. "Hi, I'm Chucky, wanna play?" And Suzanne knew what was coming, and she would scream every single time she heard it. The malevolence, the absolute evilness of conditioning Suzanne to know what was coming next. Wow. That takes something so intrinsically dark in a human condition that it is so rare. And I mean that what we're talking about now is a malevolence so deep, so rare, so dark. This person enjoys enjoys provoking that reaction from this child, letting her know, be ready, this is going to hurt. Now, at some point during Suzanne's confinement, Powell's boyfriend Lee and brother Pook, they arrive. Do they help? Do they tell the group, what are you doing? What are you doing? Stop. Instead of leaving and calling the police, they just join in with the abuse and torture. They just join in like a pack of hungry, angry wolves. At this point, Suzanne has actually been starved for days. And she's been lying in her own waste, her own urine, her own feces. Bear in mind, she's cut badly as well, and what that can mean for infection. When waste gets into open wounds, it can cause incredible problems, including blood poisoning. Now, because these two are new to the scene, well, they're disgusted by the smell. So the way that they manage this is, as a group, they untie her and then they dump her in the bath. And that bath is full of concentrated disinfectant. So they end up scrubbing her. They're using this stiff scrubbing brush and they're using a broom. Suzanne's just screaming in agony. Can you imagine how strong disinfectant would feel going into your open wounds, into your open burns? And they are scrubbing her so hard with these brushes that they're literally removing skin in places. And she gets left with abrasions and cuts all over her body. Again, the fact that they felt that they could strip her and scrub her, her body. And yet they felt that they had a right to abuse her that way. And you would imagine that at this point, just seeing somebody in so much agony and the damage that it's being doing to their body, because they are witnessing this, they're witnessing the injuries, you would think that that would hopefully turn their stomach, secondly prick their conscience, and ideally make them take a step back and say enough. Enough. But no. Because McNeely then decides that what they need to do next is to pull out Suzanne's teeth. Pook goes and finds a pair of pliers. At this point, they remove the gag and they order her to open her mouth. And can you imagine? Can you imagine what's going to go through her head at this moment in time? We all know what it's like to hurt our teeth, to chip our teeth. God forbid we expose a nerve in our teeth. It is a cold, brutal agony. And she knows what's coming. She's been so badly abused already. She knows that this isn't something that they're frightening her with. This is something they intend to do. At this point, he tells Suzanne he's going to rip her teeth out. Powell, McNeely and Dudson watch from the doorway. They're not offended by this. They're not scared by this. They're enjoying it. Pook then tries to tear out one of her inside the teeth. But for any of you who, like me, have had teeth removed, you will see that sometimes the dentist literally has to place his knee on your chest almost to pull it out, because we are human bodies. We are resilient. There is a resistance. We are formed not to break in so many ways. So it's not an easy feat to pull out a healthy tooth. And he doesn't manage to initially. He just breaks and chips the teeth. But again, the dehumanization, the impact on Suzanne with every chip, with every break, she knows that this is ultimately going somewhere potentially tragic for her. Because he can't initially get that tooth out, he gets angry. So he starts to hit her teeth with the pliers, causes further damage. And finally, he grips her tooth and he pulls it with such force that he pulls Suzanne's head forward. Her tooth snaps and it exposes the nerves. The pain, God. The pain must have been utterly excruciating. And then he repeats the process on the other incisor tooth. And what is absolutely breathtaking is that he laughed the whole time. The whole time. And what makes this even more tragic than what I'm telling you now, because it's almost impossible to imagine this story could be any more tragic, is there were opportunities to save that young girl. Suzanne could have been saved, because at one point, David Hill is an 18-year-old acquaintance of the gang. He's in the property and he hears Dudson shout, "Shut up, you slag," from the back room. So he asks what's happening. They aren't afraid to show him. This is how delusional this group are. They're proud of what they're doing. They don't think they're doing anything wrong. They think Suzanne deserves it. She's just a piece of meat to them. They can treat her however they want to. They're not thinking about repercussions. I don't think she's worth anything for repercussions. They see her as so vulnerable that they can do whatever they want with her and nothing's going to affect them. So they show Suzanne to him. She's restrained on a bed. He can see that she's been seriously abused. There's dried blood around her mouth where these teeth have been ripped out. Later, they are so confident that nobody's going to do anything about this situation that they actually go out. They leave him alone in the house with her. And Suzanne just says, "Please get me some help." And he tells her he can't. So he asks her who she was, and she says her name's Suzanne. She asks if he'd untie her. Again, he says he can't do anything. Now, he would later claim he was scared of Lee and the repercussions if he did try to help. And on one level, okay, I can say it's terrifying, the fact that this gang of people, if they can even be called people, had such an influence over this individual that he was too terrified to help. You know, they knew that they could leave someone alone with their victim and that they wouldn't intervene. But, you know, I don't have a lot of patience with giving people those excuses. Because literally, I know me and I know all of you watching now. Damn straight we would have freed her. Damn straight we would have called the police. Damn straight we would have made sure they were banged to rights on that day and Suzanne survived. Because they're going to get arrested. There's nothing that they could have done to that guy because he would have made sure that they were brought to justice and Suzanne would have been saved. So I don't give people an excuse that this is gang mentality and fear of repercussions. He could have saved her. He refused to. She begged him for help and he said no. During that time that Suzanne was being held captive in torture, Lee and Dudson actually helped her sister's fiancé, Suzanne's sister's fiancé, Paul Barlow, fix his car. They literally were helping a guy who was going to marry Suzanne's sister, all the while knowing that Suzanne was tied up and being tortured and abused. He actually later told authorities that when they were doing that, they had every single opportunity to raise the alarm. They had a relationship with him. They could have said, "Suzanne's in really bad danger." And as he said, "I would have immediately rescued Suzanne," but they said nothing. I do not give them any more grace because of their fear to excuse them for any of this because they made those choices. They weren't concerned about Suzanne at all. They didn't think that there was anything wrong happening. I even wonder whether they felt some power because they knew that whilst they were helping Suzanne's sister's fiancé, that she was basically being slowly murdered somewhere that they knew. On the 14th of December 1992, this is a week after she was first abducted, well, the gang gets word that Suzanne's stepfather is worried about her. This man is not even biologically connected to this girl. He's worried about her. He's the one looking for her. Really makes you think, doesn't it? about this man who really didn't have to be in Suzanne's life at all. He wasn't related to her. He'd split up with his wife, who was then her mother. And yet it's he who's concerned. It's he that is worried that Suzanne may be at risk of harm. So at this point, they are concerned because, of course, as soon as people start looking for her, it might get out on the street that she was seen with them, or even worse, someone might confide to the police that they know where she is. So they decide it's not safe to keep her at the house. In the early hours, they put a balaclava on Suzanne's head. They drag her from the house and they dump her in the boot of a stolen Fiat Panda. It's winter. She's wearing just knickers and leggings. Her body's bruised, battered, broken. The cold air would be agonising to her exposed nerves in her teeth. McNeely Powell, Glyn Powell and Dudson were in the car. Lee and Poot remain at the house. Those in the car then drive 15 miles towards, it's along a narrow lane at Wernith Low near Romilly. It's the outskirts of Stockport for those of you who know Manchester. During that journey, it's recalled by others that McNeely was just giggling. Just imagine what they have done. Imagine who they have in the boot of that car, where they are going. Imagine how you would be feeling. McNeely is giggling. We're talking serial killer type level of psychopath here, aren't we? They're enjoying this. When they arrive at their destination, they drag Suzanne from the boot. They push her down an embankment into brambles. Bear in mind how terrified she would be. Bear in mind the cold air hitting her skin, the fact that she's mostly naked and she's got no hair. She's just a shadow of her former self. And suddenly they open the boots, they drag her out and she's being pushed down an embankment. And I imagine, what was she thinking? My God, please let them leave me here. Please let them leave me here. The hope, the momentary hope. She lies in a fetal position, that naturally protective way that we lie when we're in pain, when we're hurt. But they have come prepared. McNeely douses her in petrol and then tries, albeit unsuccessfully, to set her alight. So Dudson and Glyn Powell then take over. And finally, they ignited the petrol. And bear in mind, when that petrol would have hit Suzanne, she would have smelt the fumes. It's such a distinctive smell. She would have known what their intention was. As she went up in flames, that battered body writhing in agony, she began screaming, just screaming in agony. And even though she goes up in flames, they initially go out. So Glyn Powell goes back and uses his lighter on Suzanne's back to reignite her. Imagine that. Just going back again and again. And if that isn't disturbing enough, that doesn't display the kind of excuses for human beings we're discussing right now. McNeely watched in glee and sang "Burn, Baby, Burn," and the others laughed. Satisfied that they killed her at this point, they leave her for dead and they drive back to Moston, where Lee and Pook were waiting for them. In fact, on the way, they stop and buy alcohol. They have just set fire to a 16-year-old girl and left her for dead, and they couldn't care less. They found the whole experience exciting and fun, and now they've got alcohol so they can go and celebrate their kill. Except Suzanne wasn't dead. despite those catastrophic, utterly horrific injuries, despite those beyond extensive burns, and they were beyond extensive, Suzanne was still alive. And there is something of a warrior in that child. I mean this. There is something resilient within that girl's spirit that is striking to me. Because in that state, she managed to crawl naked up the embankment. She managed to go 400 metres. And at that point, three men who were driving to work, they find her at 6:10 a.m. Obviously absolutely horrified, desperate to get her help. They take her to the nearby property, who then raises the alarm. The homeowners, Michael and Margaret Coop, obviously their instant reaction is to call for an ambulance and to try to comfort her. And Margaret would later recount the absolutely terrible state that Suzanne was in, but she was so polite to them. I told you early on, one of the remarkable things about this young woman was, in spite of her difficult life, she was always pleasant, she was always kind. And she thanked them constantly, repeatedly, saying, "Thank you for helping me." When I looked at what this couple said about their experience of seeing her in that moment, they said that she had just horrific injuries, so bad that her features had been burned away. And Margaret, because she was naturally a caregiver and nurturer in that moment, all she felt was this protective mechanism, and she actually went to put her arms around her, but Suzanne was in so much agony, she couldn't even be touched. She couldn't even be granted the nurture that this loving human being who was there to protect her could offer her. She said both hands appeared like ash. Her legs were just like raw meat, and her feet appeared to be badly charred. Her head was shaved, and there were recent, not new, cuts to her head. Her face was almost featureless. Her hands were red, raw, and black from the fingertips. Her legs were red from top to bottom, and she couldn't bear anything near her legs. And let's remember, the men who found her, this couple who were trying to soothe her, they are witnessing a woman who is walking dead, essentially. The trauma that they themselves would feel looking at this individual rendered featureless because of the torture. Whilst they waited for paramedics to arrive, one of the things that they were able to give Suzanne were glasses of water. She drank 6 glasses. And that's because she'd had no food or water for days. Because she was so injured, her hands were so beyond repair, they actually had to hold the glass to her charred lips so she could take the water in. At this point, she's taken by ambulance to Stockport Infirmary, and later they have to transfer her to the specialist burns unit at Withington because her injuries are just so horrific, so extensive. But despite that, despite the fact that she's endured this horror, she's crawled 400 metres to at least some kind of sanctuary, she's still able to tell the authorities who her attackers were. She wasn't just able to tell them who did it. She described what had been done to her. She gave them Powell's address. The investigating officers were so shocked by Suzanne's injuries that some were literally crying. And these are coppers who see this stuff. You know, they see people beaten up. They see people who are tortured. They see people who are murdered. But her injuries were so shocking that they couldn't handle it. And they were so totally blown away by this that they actually did a collection. They sent her flowers in hospital. So these are people doing a job And I think we sometimes forget that these police officers are looking into the eyes of these victims and seeing what has happened. And they are humans who feel compassion and anger, desire for justice. But they do this every day. Yet in this case, they were so broken by what they saw, they needed to do more. So they collected money so they could send the flowers and say, we see you. We see what happened to you. Even though she managed to give all of this information to the police, I mean, what a hero, what a warrior to stay awake, to stay conscious, to stay cogent, to express all the information that they needed to bring a case against those perpetrators. Not long after she'd done that, she falls into a coma. She never regained consciousness from that coma. And ultimately, she succumbed to those injuries 3 days later on the 18th of December, 1992. The pathologist who looked at Suzanne after death later established the extent of Suzanne's injuries, and they said that she suffered around 80% burns to her body. These caused internal complications and she died as a result of multiple organ failure. And at hospital, the burns were so severe that her parents were actually unable to identify her. In fact, the only way that they were able to identify her was to take a partial thumbprint because it was the only part of her hand that hadn't been badly damaged by fire. At this point, the police have got all of the perpetrators banged to rights. They go to Powell's address on the 14th of December at 7:30 a.m. And I know that you and I and everyone watching this wishes that we could have been there to see these people arrested. The house was horrific. Inside, it was just full of rubbish. And instead of actually having a couch, there were just stolen car seats lined up against the wall. I guess that they thought that was clever. You know, a bit of a screw to the police, isn't it? A nice little touch where they line those seats up because it's all under the police's nose. They don't need a couch. They just use the cars that they've stolen seats instead. Anyway, they find and arrest five members of the gang there. You may hope at this point, bear in mind the fact that these individuals know what they've done, therefore should know what they are facing, that the magnitude of their actions would have sunk in. No. You know what Powell and McNeely were doing? They were just laughing and joking during the arrest. Another person that I've covered on this channel is Joanna Dennehy. She too was a psychopathic serial killer who laughed and joked when she was being booked in when she was being charged. And it is so disconcerting because when you think about firstly what they've done and secondly what they're facing, laughter, humour is as far away from what could be expected. And yet here we are. This is how different these kind of human predators are. They don't see the world like you or I. At the property, the police find a bloody pair of pliers on the shelf, which is near a Christmas tree, which makes it even more macabre, doesn't it? That we're talking about this time of year, a time of celebration, gifts, of hope. And there's that pair of bloody pliers where they ripped out that poor girl's teeth. They also find the two teeth that Pook had torn out from Suzanne's mouth, and they find a shaved hair in the wheelie bin outside. All six of them are charged with attempted murder and kidnapping. And initially, they all go, well, at the end of the day, you have turned up at our house after being informed by the person that we have murdered that we did it. You have all the DNA evidence that you could ever wish. In fact, for a forensics expert, this is the dream site to explore because there are pieces of the person everywhere. Therefore, probably going to be best to just go guilty. Bear in mind, the courts aren't happy when you lie about these things. But no, no. They're like, didn't do it. Oh, I wish I was an officer in these situations who got to interrogate these idiots. So just wait 1 minute there. You're saying that you had nothing to do with the murder of Suzanne. Nothing. Can I draw your attention to her teeth on the side. We were just going to put those under the pillow for the tooth fairy. I'm not buying your story. I don't care. I'm completely innocent. Why is her hair in the wheelie bin? I'll get back to you on that. Literally, it drives me crazy. Anyway, fortunately, Dudson, who clearly recognises there's no way out of this, begins to relay details of what had happened. And the reason for this is his father has basically said, look, you have to start telling the truth. Because you can imagine, can't you, being a relative of these individuals, you're going to be stood there thinking, how have I formed you? What is wrong with you? And the idea of them making it worse by just being even more deceptive is something that's going to not stand well with you. So thank God, his father, who clearly has a moral compass, tells Dudson you need to tell the truth. So following Suzanne's death, because now she's died and Dudson has started to relay this information, and let's be honest, they had enough evidence to put them away full stop without them even uttering a word, but they then get charged with murder. So the six defendants plead guilty to false imprisonment. However, every single one of them initially denies murder charges. It's unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. And bear in mind, now Dudson is talking, so the police and the prosecution are absolutely aware that it was a murder. But you can imagine that they're all thinking, well, I'll downplay my part in it and I'll blame somebody else. And that, whilst is ineffective when there is this amount of evidence, can in other circumstances cause big problems for juries, because you have to beyond reasonable doubt believe that the individual you are trying definitely carried out the killing. So they are, to some degree, trying to manipulate the circumstances. Yeah, I definitely did kidnap, I'll admit that, but I didn't kill them. The trial commences on the 16th of November 1993. It's at Manchester Crown Court. As you would imagine, each of the defendants just basically downplays the role that they had in Suzanne's torture and murder. So Powell, who is so guilty that if there was a gondola to hell, she would be on it right now. Well, she claims that she stayed in a car and that she was terrified as she watched all the others set light to Suzanne. Were you that terrified? You were in a car. Why didn't you drive somewhere and alert them to the fact that they were murdering this poor kid? But that's her story. She said that all she thought was they were going to take her into the woods and just let her go. Yes, I think we can all agree, Powell, that you might have been the kind of person to take her into the woods and set her free, but only if you were then going to start the Hunger Games with her. Anyway, she claims that she had locked Suzanne in the cupboard initially, remember, because that's what she admitted to doing to the police, but she's got a cover story for this. It was for her own safety. Yes, we've all done it, haven't we? We've all done that. I mean, who hasn't, in a situation where we're afraid for somebody's safety, thought, well, I have a solution. I'll just lock them in a downstairs cupboard. Said nobody's saving anyone ever. So this is her story. And she even goes so far as to say, I loved her like a sister. Oh, how dare she? And what she says is that she was actually terrified of her ex-husband, Glyn Powell. Which is a little bit weird, because she actually sent that ex-husband, Glyn Powell, a love letter whilst in prison. Not the brightest of things to do. Are you trying to suggest that you're terrified of this individual? Glyn Powell, by the way, claimed that he still loved his ex-wife. And he says that the only reason that he went ahead with any of this was because he wanted to please her. As you do. I mean, who hasn't considered that a loving thing to do? What do you want me to do? You want me to torture and murder somebody for you as a way of professing my love? Sounds totally reasonable. Are there some cards that we can buy that can express this? There's probably arranged by birthdays, isn't there, about murdering and torturing defenseless women as an expression of love? Said nobody ever, ever. So that's his excuse. Now, McNeely admits that she injected Suzanne with amphetamines, but you love this one. You're going to love this one. I can imagine the defense were like, please God, please God, give me somebody that can at least come up with a plausible reason for their behavior in this situation. And when McNeely speaks to them, I bet they were like, I'm literally in another universe where stupidity and things making sense are now nonsense. Because McNeely says that, yeah, I did inject Suzanne with amphetamines, but I did it to protect her. Of course you did. I mean, who isn't going around injecting people who are tied to beds with amphetamines if it's not to protect them? Yeah, apparently she said that if she hadn't injected her with amphetamines, the others would have injected her with heroin. Wow, McNeely, you're the kind of hero that every story needs, aren't you? But that was literally her reasoning. December 1993, this is following a 22-day trial, and it did take almost 10 hours of deliberation. The jury find the gang guilty of the following offences, and let's be honest, we all knew there were going to be guilty verdicts in this. Bernadette McNeely, she gets found guilty of murder and conspiracy to cause GBH. She gets a life imprisonment with a minimum tariff of 25 years. And she actually gets incarcerated on the same wing with Rose West and Myra Hindley. And apparently she had a relationship with Hindley during her time there. That's not weird. I mean, arguably they all do seem to have the same personalities, don't they? So I imagine that they had quite a lot in common with one another, being heinous excuses for humans who really don't deserve the air that they breathe. I guess that might have connected them. Jean Powell, they get found guilty of murder and conspiracy to cause GBH. Again, a life imprisonment with a minimum tariff of 25 years. Anthony Dudson, he gets found guilty of murder and conspiracy to cause GBH. He got detained indefinitely with a minimum tariff of 18 years, but he successfully appealed his sentence in 2002 and his minimum tariff was reduced to 16 years, got moved to an open prison in 2009. And that's a place where prisoners are basically trusted to complete sentences with minimal supervision and perimeter security. Often they don't even get locked up in their prison cells. Ultimately, he got released in 2013. Glyn Powell, guilty of murder and conspiracy to cause GBH. They got a life imprisonment with a minimum of 25 years as their tariff. Now, both Jeffrey Lee and Clifford Pook, well, they got acquitted of murder because they didn't actually travel in the car that night. Lee had already pleaded guilty to false imprisonment, so they got sentenced to 12 years, but successfully appealed the sentence in 1994 and was reduced to 9 years. So ultimately got released early in 1998. They'd only served 5 years. Pook had pleaded guilty to conspiracy to cause GBH and false imprisonment, and they got 15 years. So they got released in May 2001. Because they'd served 8 years of their sentence, so they served enough of their sentence to get them out on license. Now, McNeely, the wonderful, joyful, lovely, pro-social, wouldn't you like her for a neighbour? McNeely, I only inject people with amphetamines to protect them. Well, they caused further controversy in 1996. Why? Because it turned out that she was having an affair with the prison Governor Mike Martin. Whole heap of not right. She gets transferred to another prison and then her minimum term gets reduced from 25 years to 24 years on appeal in 2012 on apparent fact that she's a model prisoner. Is she? She a model prisoner? Really? I mean, I think you're just talking about a model prisoner who is having a relationship with the prison governor. I don't think that's good behaviour. Well, it might be as far as the prison governor's concerned, but for the rest of us, yes, it's an abuse of power on his part, but it's probably a whole heap of manipulation on her part. But she got a year off a sentence because that's justice, said with a majorly ironic tone. Apparently as well, she's filled with remorse for her crime and she's completed lots of courses while she was in prison, from physical education to horticulture. So you never know, she could be coming to a garden near you soon. Apparently now she's committed to helping others. Committed to helping others. So ultimately she gets freed in 2015 after she served 21 years. And she basically leaves prison and moves into the same property as a friend that she made inside. And that friend was Karen Matthews. Yeah, that Karen Matthews. You know, the one who basically served 8 years for child neglect and faking the abduction of her daughter in 2008. Well, they seem like the perfect neighbours, don't they? One would be thrilled at such truly committed to changing the world for the better type of human beings moving into your neighbourhood. Listen, I get it. Maybe she has changed her ways. Certainly not a taste in friends, but maybe she has changed her ways. Maybe she's learned and grown and she is full of remorse. But I'm going to be really honest with you. I think what they did to Suzanne needed more of a heavy sentence. Genuinely, I do. What they did to that child, it wasn't simply a scenario where somebody acts in rage and murders somebody. It was something that was drawn out, it was protracted, it was made to inflict the most amount of pain on a 16-year-old kid. And they did it with glee. I get that people change. But for the most part, I don't know people in my life with the depths of such evil that they could act in any way, shape or form like what I've described today. How can you really change from that level of malevolence? Let me know if you believe you can. Maybe you can, maybe they have. But for me, I don't necessarily think that Suzanne got justice. Her case is so tragic because it feels like the deck was stacked against her from the start. She obviously didn't have the most supportive home life. She was a really good person, and yet she got born into a culture of violence and crime, and in that bid to just be accepted and liked, just because she wanted to fit in, she got paid back by being tortured and murdered by the people that she thought were her friends, by a gang of useless, criminal, drug-addicted misfits who just legitimised one another's sadistic, barbaric behaviour with utterly horrific consequences. There were so many chances as well for Suzanne to have been saved. And it's beyond shocking to me that she could have been held captive and tortured for days in a terrorist house. A terrorist house. Come on, I've lived in a terrorist house. I know that I heard my neighbours farting, let alone torturing someone to death. Someone should have heard. It's like there was a complete ambivalence of the pain and suffering of others. In the media, there was a big story that was made about the moral decline in society. And one of the things that they did at the time was they blamed video nasties for influencing the gang who killed Suzanne. But in truth, there's absolutely no evidence of this. The gang didn't even own a copy of Child's Play, the horror film. To be fair, there wasn't even a video player in Powell's house. And the soundtrack that they'd used in Suzanne's torture had actually been recorded off Piccadilly Radio. For those of you who don't know Piccadilly Radio, it was very big when I was a child. It's now not known as that. But the point was, they had just taken that from the general play on the radio. When you look at this case, what we have is the perfect storm of young, highly dysfunctional individuals, all with troubled upbringings, all involved to some degree with drugs and crime, all of limited education and intelligence. But what makes this stand out, what I think makes for all of us listening to this feel transfixed by how this played out, is that it was really driven by two evil, sadistic women. They were the ringleaders. So the problem in our society wasn't violent horror films. The problem was society itself. Suzanne is a product of that society. This case was a hard one to tell. It's unusual that I tell a story where the torturers are two women driving the destruction. They were the ringleaders. Without those, this would never have happened. And for what? The stories they made up in their heads. And even if those stories had been true in reality, it's irrelevant. They were negligible. The slurs that Suzanne had apparently carried out were nothing. And that nothing led to that 16-year-old child's life being ended so horrifically. And like I said, I want to leave today with that memory for all of you that, yeah, Suzanne didn't get to live a life. She should have grown into a woman. She should have children of her own, maybe even grandchildren now. She should have been somebody who contributed to our society. That is true. But my God, she left her legacy. Those final meters that she crawled and those final words that she spoke, she made sure that beyond the grave, she sent down each and every one of them. And that makes her a hero in this story. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.